All right, it's 5 o'clock on Hide and Behind the Music Stand. I'm your host, Patty Ryan, and with me is Sam Park, who is a violinist based in Houston, Texas. He teaches at Lone Star College, is a member of the conductorless string ensemble, Kinetic, and is a doctoral candidate at Rice University. And we'll be talking about whiskey. Welcome, Sam. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me here, Patty.
Of course. I'm excited for us to have a little happy hour situation later in this episode with you. It's going to be a lot of fun. So I met you my final year at Tanglewood, which was what, 2014. The Econolodge was a real living situation, apparently. But yeah, I mean, it must have been friends of friends that we met. I don't think we ever did any chamber music together at that point, right?
No. You know, my first memory of you was in that lounge together, or that common lounge where I just remember you were sitting in a couch just with like a glass of, might have been even whiskey.
And oh, really? Yeah.
I might have just joined you one time, and I think from then on, we became friends.
Oh my gosh, that's actually kind of awesome.
Yeah.
That this is very full circle.
Yeah, I remember many nights of us just, you know, just chilling at the couches and drinking.
Yeah, it was, I mean, that's what you do. I mean, that's the, that's the music festival life, especially at that age and at that festival. But also, I can never let it go. There's that one moment in Symphony Fantastique that you just really played in the hole. And it's just one of my favorite memories.
I was so proud and confident about coming in a measure early.
I know. And it's like, when you look back at or listen back to the recording, it's just like, oh, there's Sam. I don't know. It's just like, I can't help but to bring that back up, that memory back up.
Yeah, I love that we have a recording for us to all memorialize.
Exactly. You know? Yeah. So then you eventually came to Rice was it for the doctorate?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Okay. So we overlapped at Rice for like a year or something. Two years?
A year. Yeah.
Yeah. And when Natalie was asking me for violinists to recommend for Kinetic, your name instantly popped in my mind, and I told her, and like, it's really kind of cool that I'm like, yay, I brought Sam back. I brought him on board the Kinetic train.
Oh yeah, I remember when it was like after an orchestra rehearsal when you took this side, you're like, Sam, I have to ask you a serious question. And my heart was just thumping, like, what's wrong? What kind of serious questions are you going to ask me? And then you're like, oh, do you want to join Kinetic? I was like, oh yeah, sure.
Yeah, and now like I feel like you're such a core member or a staple in the ensemble, so fearless leader sometimes.
Yeah. lots of intense concerts.
Yeah, well, but good, right? I haven't.
Good concerts. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, yeah. Anyway, so Sam, what is your most insane performance story?
Sure. Last year, I performed the entirety of Paganini violin caprices.
What?
Yeah.
When? How?
Yeah, for my final recital.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and it was this was April 2021. So this was at a time when Rice was still not having audiences in because of the pandemic.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I thought, well, you know, might as well, you know, just go all out and try out these caprices, especially because, well, you know, there was nothing to do during the pandemic.
So you practice Paganini caprices during the pandemic?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Good for you. Congratulations also. That's an accomplishment.
Oh, thanks. I wouldn't say like, okay, it was definitely not my best performance at all, you know, but you know.
But I don't believe
I'm at least glad. Okay. I'm glad that like I did it. You know?
Yeah, I know what you mean. Would you ever want to repeat that concert with a live audience?
I think, you know, I would love to have another go at it.
How long is that concert?
It was over an hour and a half.
Okay.
Without intermission. So I just went straight through from 1 to
24. Oh my God. That's intense, Sam. What?
Yeah. Man, kudos, especially to those, I think there were 6 or 7 people in the audience who watched through the whole entire thing. Like, man, I got to hand it to them.
I was like, did you buy them ice cream afterward or something? I'm just kidding.
Man, I mean, they definitely deserve.
Wow, that's insane. Congratulations. That's definitely an accomplishment. Not every violinist can say that. They've done that.
Yeah.
Do you think that it's made you, like, do you have any reflections from that experience, either as going through that particular canon of work or anything technical on your instrument? Any comfort that you've achieved after? I don't know. I'm just trying to think of
anything. Yeah. Well, during the pandemic, when there were very little music performances going on, you know, being able to work on, or just having a goal in mind, okay, I'm going to hopefully in the near future perform these Paganini caprices. That
I see.
Kept me sane throughout the pandemic.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's how I like to think of that whole process. I'm not exactly sure if I've gotten any better personally as a violinist, but I think it was a nice distraction from everything else that was going on, you know, in the last 2 years.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, congrats again. I keep saying it, but that yeah, seriously thanks. That's a feat.
Yeah.
A foot. Never mind. All right. Are you ready for some spitfire questions?
Sure.
Mahler or Bruckner?
Oh my God. Mahler. Mahler.
Okay.
Although I also love Bruckner. I think my first single with performance was that Bruckner 4.
I think so. Yeah. That's
yeah. A good one. And who was the conductor? Stefan Asbury?
Was it?
Was that his name?
The British guy?
Yeah, the British guy.
Yeah, then it must have been Asbury.
Yeah. There are so many ways in which, you know, you can have such a bad introduction to Bruckner. But he gave, yeah, like, you know, the way that he, like, introduced us to his works, like, man, he did such a great job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Shout out to Stefan Asbury.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, but also I remember that concert well, very fondly too. But Mahler, because?
Mahler, just because there's so much more variety in symphonies.
Okay.
That's simply it.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay. Debussy or Ravel?
Ravel. I'm this personally more of a structure guy. Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
I lean more towards Ravel. Also, yeah, I'm still a bit fan of Debussy also.
I mean, right. I'm not yeah. saying we're not canceling any of these composers. Yeah. Yeah, okay. Cats or dogs?
I'm a dog person, but what I envision my lifestyle, I think I will probably be a cat person.
Okay, so you're actually a cat person, but you like dogs.
I like dogs, yeah.
Okay, what's your favorite dog breed?
I don't think I have a distinct favorite, but I did not really used to like Chihuahuas very much until I took care of Paul Cantor's dog. I think he's a mixed Chihuahua breed. He calls him Moose.
Yes.
And he was, I know that Chihuahuas have this reputation of being these loud, yappy, you know, animals, but yeah. Moose was the most docile, you know, like, yeah. Sweet, you know, little dog. And
I mean, I wouldn't. Yeah, I wouldn't expect any dog less for Paul Cantor. I mean, that's. He brings
I
out
Moose
that
is his favorite, yeah. And I can see why.
Yeah, shout out to Moose. I guess. I
don't yes.
Appetizer or dessert?
I'm a dessert guy.
Mm-hmm. Sparkling or still water?
Still water.
Fan favorite question: alternate universe musical instrument.
Probably the cello.
Really? I'm surprised.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not surprised because the cello is awesome, but I mean, like, I'm surprised that you say a cello.
The cello or piano.
Okay.
I think both those instruments, you still have a great wealth of repertoire. They're both very versatile instruments. So either cello or piano for me.
So ideally, you'd want to be in a piano trio and play all of the parts. Okay.
Yeah.
Just a Sam piano trio. Like that's...
in the alternate universe.
Exactly. Yeah. Early bird or night owl?
Night owl.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, by far.
Okay.
Yeah.
Pandemic guilty pleasure? That's not Paganini?
Well, the pandemic is when I bought my Nintendo Switch.
You have a Switch?
Yeah, I have a Switch now.
Sam,
yeah.
We have to be friends.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I remember a year or so before the pandemic when you got your Nintendo Switch and you were so excited about it. I remember that very much.
Yeah, I mean, it's my only video gaming console, so it's the only thing I gotta be excited about, I guess.
Uh-huh.
So you played video. What games
did
you play?
Yeah, all the great games, you know, Breath of the Wild, Super Mario Odyssey.
Uh-huh.
I played Fire Emblem.
Okay.
The Three Houses. That was also really great, too. The one I'm playing most recently is Celeste.
I don't know that game.
Oh, it's a 2D platformer. It's about this metaphorical climbing up the mountain to, you know, overcome your hardships kind of deal. But the platforming stuff is challenging, so it takes up a lot of my time, which is great.
I know what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you still got to write a paper, Sam. So.
I do. Yeah. Yeah.
Can you multitask? No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, I wish.
Right? I know.
Yeah.
Favorite professor shout out?
At CIM, there was a music theory professor named Tim Cutler. Amazing, amazing professor. He really thinks very highly of his students when developing his curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
I think about the best interest for the conservatory. But there was, I wasn't the greatest student though. Like, you know, I would miss a lot of classes.
And
there was one day, apparently, when I missed class, he rounded up all the other students and said, "Everyone play a prank on Sam, you know, because he's been missing, like, you know, all these classes.
Like,
pretend to have a huge exam. There's supposedly no exam in the class, but he's like, Sam probably doesn't know that there's no exam. So we're going to, like, fake an exam."
Oh, my gosh.
And so I just remember one day, like, yeah, coming to class and being like, "Oh, there's a test. Okay, I guess I'll take this test."
Oh my gosh, that's hilarious. So so everyone else was just like being quiet while you were
They were all staring at me while I was looking through this six-page packet. And I was just looking through, I think it was a good 3 to 4 minutes until like I got to the last page and it says, oh, you know, you've been pranked. And I'm like, oh. I see.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome. Yeah. And then what happened? Did everyone just start laughing at you? Probably. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Like I was, it took me a while, like a good like 15 seconds to actually realize what was going on. Like, really? Oh, wow. Okay.
Did your teacher grade the test?
Oh, no.
Oh, man. Because I'm so curious, like what you got, like what you got scored.
I think I might have done a couple questions on first page, but I looked through the
other. Oh, you're just like trying to see how much content there is.
I was like, wow, is this really the class that I'm taking?
Oh my gosh, that's hilarious.
Yeah.
Okay, so, I mean, is that your one teacher?
Then at Juilliard, I took a class by Eric Wen on Haydn symphonies. Mm-hmm. Yeah, also incredible, such a sweet professor. And then, I forget this other professor's name, James Kurtz, I believe, who taught a class on Wagner's Ring, and he's been teaching it since the 1980s.
Whoa.
Yeah, and I had no introduction to Wagner before, but that just lit a fire in me after taking his class. So
yeah,
shout out to him too.
Sure. Most inspired musical hero of any genre?
Well, just the person in my mind at the moment is Nathan Milstein.
Oh, sure. Okay.
Yeah.
You want to explain a little bit for people?
He's a Russian violinist of the 20th century. Russian, I think he was active in the States more so, but yeah, a Russian American, I believe. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what was fascinating about him is that, well, he's what we would consider like a violinist, mm-hmm. where the way that he played on a violin looks so easy. Mm-hmm. He could play virtually anything. And because of that, it seemed like in all of his performances, he was just experimenting around, playing around, improvising, just playing things in the moment. And that's, that's a musical hero I would aspire to.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. Having that facility to be able to be that improvisatory and experimenting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Most transformative performance experience?
I would say a Rice Orchestra performance after Hurricane Harvey, when we got to play Don Quixote. I just remember, maybe the performance was great, but I just remember just trying to figure out what life was after Hurricane Harvey.
Yeah.
Yeah, after such devastation. I think that was, in terms of kind of the emotional impact of that particular performance, of the tenacity of all of us in the orchestra and also in the audience.
Uh-huh.
I think for me, that stands out as a very memorable experience.
Yeah, I mean, did you feel specifically that everyone kind of there was needing to be healed in some way? You know, that kind of communal moment?
I remember most of us healed by that time, but I think, at least for me, I was okay, completely okay during Hurricane Harvey, but just like, I just remember, wow, we were able to accomplish this just less than a month after that devastation.
I
felt like, okay, that was nice to have.
Okay. Desert island piece of any genre?
I'd say Beethoven quartets.
Yeah.
Yeah, I heard that you did a whole cycle.
I did!
Yeah, how did that go?
Oh, it was, transformative. That's the only... Thanks for asking, I guess. I'm the person who's supposed to be interviewing you. No, but it was, transformative. I knew all the quartets before even playing and performing them, but then there's something about that moment when you don't know when the next time you're going to play these pieces again that changes the way you play, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, but okay, well, that's, again... Which Beethoven quartet?
Either the 127 E flat.
Yeah.
Or 135.
Okay, so
F major.
The bookends of the late quartets.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can have both. I'll give you both.
I love all the others, but the other three are maybe just... Well, okay, if it's a desert piece, maybe I'll go for longer ones. But, but for the most emotional impact, I love the 177 and 135.
177?
Or 127, sorry. 127 and 135.
Yeah.
Yeah, the slow movements are to die for both.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about. Yeah, those slow movements are just so good.
You're gorgeous.
So good, yeah. Well, Sam, you have finished the Spitfire questions. Congratulations.
Thank you. Oh, is that Moose's sign?
No, I quit. No. I should have done that. No, I was trying to do the beginning of 135.
I see.
Oh, it's too sharp. It's not quite the same effect. It has to be like, I have to get like a bass slide whistle or something.
Oh, yeah. You have that range.
Yeah. All right, Sam, can you walk me through your musical origin story? How did you discover music? How did you discover the violin? When did you decide that that was going to be your path in life professionally? And walk me through the steps of where you are today.
Sure. With many Asian households, you know, I started the violin at age of 5 because of my parents, you know, because it will help me, you know, become a more studious student.
So it was for academic reasons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
More so. And I remember, distinctly remember not enjoying it for a good 5 years. Mm-hmm. And then I think it was when I was 10 or 11 when I started enjoying it a little bit. Yeah. And I,
what do you
I
think changed?
Being in youth orchestra, I think. Uh-huh. Being around others who...
Friends, essentially.
Yeah, who play. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, to get friends. I think that's what changed. Mm-hmm. And then it was until I was 15 or 16. That was when I decided I wanted to become a musician.
Wow.
And I think that's relatively late.
Oh.
Yeah, I was still on the sidelines for a while and not wanting to really commit until, yeah, I was 16 years old.
Okay, so can I ask what changed there too?
I did Baby Tinglewood, Booty, Boston University Tinglewood Institute. Yeah, I think after...
I don't think we're supposed to call it Booty, but...
Booty.
But yeah.
Yeah, that's right. B-U-T-I.
Yes.
that's the proper terminology. Right. B-U-T-I. I think after doing a summer camp or so, by that age, I realized, okay, I actually really love what I'm doing. So let me make that leap.
Wow. Okay.
And yeah.
Anything else in your academics, though, that was not competing, but up there of interest? Like, I think
that was all the other part of it, too. Like, I was not doing well in academics at that point. Relatively speaking.
So your parents' plans of you using violin as a helping tool for your academics.
It was completely thwarted.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah, the only subject I was really good at was math. Mm-hmm. My worst subject by far was English. Mm-hmm. And it was that bad enough that like my parents were like, okay, music seems to be the best route for you. I think, you know, making a commitment that late in age, especially for violin, you're behind.
Hmm.
And because of that, I didn't get in anywhere my freshman year.
Oh.
Except for Arizona State University. I auditioned at Rice at Juilliard.
You did the whole circuit. Everywhere. Yeah.
I did a whole circuit and yeah, I didn't get in anywhere. But, you know, the first 2 years I stayed at Arizona State University, I absolutely loved my time there. Yeah, I studied with my teacher there, Jonathan Swartz, starting from when I was 16 years old, when I realized, okay, I have to start being serious if I want to be a music major. Mm-hmm. So I started studying with Jonathan Swartz and he gave me the skills and discipline that I sorely lacked in the better part of my musical education up till that point. So yeah, I really credit him for laying the foundations for my musical education. I think I studied with Jonathan Swartz for 4 years before I transferred to CIM for my junior year with Joel Smirnoff and John Kwan.
And CIM as in Cleveland Institute of Music.
That's right.
Those.
Yeah. And I think with Joel Smirnoff and John Kwan, I really honed in my technique.
Okay.
They were able to refine the things that I lacked a lot. So I credit them with that.
What was it like to be a transfer student?
It wasn't so bad. I'd say that I was lucky because all my credits transferred over ASU to CIM. So I didn't have to take an extra year like some other people did. So the only class I needed to take that was the Eurythmics class at CIM.
Yeah.
But other than that, like everything was basically normal.
But I mean, socially, you were okay?
Yeah, there were a couple people from Arizona that I knew.
Oh,
and some people from other summer festivals. So yeah, it wasn't so much of a transition period.
Okay.
And it was not as bad as I thought it would be.
Yeah, well, I think it's just a little bit... I guess you got kind of the best of both worlds in some ways, because for 2 years, you got Arizona State University. Like, you got the university experience in 2 years, and then you got the conservatory experience for 2 years, which is, I feel like, a lot of music students either compromise on one or the other in those kinds of experience, like life experience, not like musically.
Yeah, just to be being exposed to so many different kinds of people at ASU. I believe the student population is maybe like 70,000 something.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, many people that you come across. And I think I enjoyed that experience to be, you know, confronted with so many different people. Yeah, and in addition to that, I saved a lot of money going to ASU for 2 years and then the conservatory for the last 2 years. So after CIM, then I went to Juilliard for my master's to study with Kathy Cho. And
I just think like, you know, I mean, a lot of people, when you say that you felt like you were really behind and then it took you 4 years to then get to Juilliard, that's like 4 years, right? Not six. Okay. That's a pretty like huge growth. exponential growth.
Yeah, it took having the right teachers too, which I was so fortunate to have, because you don't have much control over that.
Right.
Either there's a good teacher in your area or not. And there happened to be a good teacher in my area, who was Jonathan Swords. And then going to CIM, the teachers who really did help me. Mm-hmm. So I also worked hard, but also, like, you know, it's also luck too, to be able to work with people that you work well with.
Sure. Okay. So you're at Juilliard now.
Yeah, Juilliard with Kathy Cho. I'd say she really is a person to go to when you want to refine your artistry, musical artistry. Mm-hmm. And I also adored her too. Yeah, she was a great logical next step to after my undergrad, which was a lot about filling in the gaps in my technique. Yeah, then after Juilliard, here I am in Houston for Rice University with Paul Cantor.
Uh-huh. What's it like going through the doctorate program?
I got a lot out of it. First, to be able to play in the Rice Orchestra. Really, like, I've been all over. Yeah, CIM, Juilliard, Arizona State, and Rice by far has the most disciplined orchestra program. So, especially as a doctoral student, where, you know, doctoral students in most places don't get the chance to play in orchestra because, you know, you're too busy with other parts of the curriculum. But at least at Rice, I had the chance to still play in an orchestra, not only a orchestra, but a fantastic one.
Yeah, yeah. Very dedicated.
Yeah. Another part of the doctoral program that was very beneficial to me was teaching, well, basically music appreciation for non-music majors or music fundamentals, I'd say. And the thing about teaching to Rice students, especially outside of the Shepherd School of Music undergrads, they're smart. Mm-hmm. And you want to teach in a way that challenges them rather than them thinking, oh, this is a blow-off class.
Right.
In addition to that, you know, it also challenged how I talk about music, to be able to talk to music to people who aren't musicians. I think that really helped me hone my skill in that area.
Well, what's the difference?
It's the balance of...
How do you be relatable, right?
Yeah, how to be relatable. Yeah, but also finding a way not to dumb it down, to be as informative as possible without being condescending. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so just trying to walk that fine line. That's what teaching at Rice taught me about. Yeah.
Okay, so now you are finishing up. You're almost done. When do you graduate from your doctorate?
So I'm hoping to graduate by this fall. But if I don't, then I have at least a semester or so afterwards to finish up.
Okay, well, good luck. And also congratulations already on all the work you've done. Can you tell me a little bit about Kinetic and your role in the group? I mean, I know I'm joking because I've like talked about Kinetic on this podcast before because I'm also a member. But yeah, I just, maybe there's some upcoming projects that listeners should know about.
Yeah. So Kinetic is a conductorless string orchestra. It's made up of 16 string musicians. And although the conductorless part is, it is an important aspect of our group in that it's more kind of like a democracy, where we value everybody's opinions within the orchestra rather than solely looking up to one person. But yeah, although that's an important aspect, I think what is personally kind of more fascinating part of Kinetic is the programming.
Yeah.
I remember 4 or 5 years ago, I think we did Jesse Montgomery's Starburst, and this was before the pandemic, this was before Black Lives Matters. And so to be able to come across composers like them and be, wow, like this is actually, like her music is quite good. And to be able to come across these little known composers, and Natalie Lin, our artistic director, being able to tie these compositions to a very thought provocative program, I think that's kind of what makes Kinetic the
vision
very interesting.
Behind it. Yeah. Yeah, totally. Also, Natalie Lin Douglas is a past guest of the podcast as well. So make sure to go and listen to her episode if you haven't yet already. She's early on in season one. No, but anyway, I totally absolutely agree. I mean, we also play some more standard things occasionally. Like we played a Bartok Divertimento at some point. You know, that's a very standard string orchestra piece. And Verklärungsnacht or Schoenberg's, et cetera, et cetera. But overall, we've played some really incredible, as you say, lesser known pieces that probably should be performed more often. In addition, we also commission works too. I mean, I'm kind of baiting you to talk about it. Do you want to talk about our upcoming concert in May?
Yeah, so in May, the program is titled Concerto Reimagined. Mm-hmm. And we're exploring the concerto medium for string orchestra. One of the pieces that we're doing is a commission by Anthony Brandt. So he's writing a concerto for string orchestra. And then in addition to his work, we're doing a little known concerto for orchestra by Roja. Mm-hmm. He's a Hollywood composer in the 20th century.
I think he's more, for some people who might are a little more nerdy, I think he wrote a viola concerto.
Yeah, I've played his viola concerto. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's a really good concerto.
Like in the orchestra, or did you play the viola?
In the orchestra.
Concerto?
In the orchestra.
Okay. Yeah. I was like, did you switch? Okay.
Yeah, I don't know his concerto for string orchestra, but his viola concerto is quite accessible. Yeah. And then as the first piece in the program, we're playing a string symphony by Mendelssohn. So that is a composer.
Harkening back to the past. Yes. So, I mean, I'm personally looking very forward. This will be my first time since the pandemic flying down and being part of Kinetic. It's been too long. So I'm incredibly excited to be a part of this project. And so any Houston listeners or anybody in the Houston area, or if you want to take a road trip down with me, you know, we'll be having that concert on May 22nd at MATCH, which is an acronym for Midtown Arts and Theater Central Houston. And that's at 6 p.m. So I'll definitely give you more information about that concert. And both Sam and I and a few others have a couple little solos. So make sure to watch out for those. All right, Sam, are you ready to take a break?
Yes, I am.
Okay, let's get our whiskey out.
Okay. Yeah.
We'll be right back. Hey, so before we continue on with the next segment, I wanted to be sure to say to my listeners to please drink responsibly. Make sure you are 21 years of age or older to enjoy a beverage, and if you found yourself to have overindulged in any way, please drink many glasses of water, eat some food, maybe take a couple milligrams of ibuprofen, and get home safely. Don't drink and drive, folks. On that note, let's get going to the rest of the show. Welcome back from the break. So Sam, when you told me that you wanted to talk about, well, you said whiskey, although I'm realizing it's scotch, but when you said you wanted to talk about whiskey as your outside interest, I said, hey, you know, why don't we get a bottle or a couple bottles together and do a little tasting on the podcast, and we can talk about, you know, what we were experiencing as we're drinking them. And so you told me to get, this is like a sampler tasting set from Total Wine.
That's right.
Yeah, it's around, price point's around $30-some. It's pretty reasonable. So do you want to talk about it a little bit?
Yeah, these are tasting samples of a scotch called Glenmorangie. And yeah, they're very accessible bottles. They're not smoky at all. I believe, at least they're original. I know they're original and it's very sweet and it's friendly.
Okay, are we going to dive in now?
Yeah, let's start with the original.
Okay, the original.
The 10-year Glenmorangie.
Do you know much about how this is made or created?
I'd say there's two different kinds of scotches. One, I think the better known scotches are the smoky scotches. The way that you get the smoke flavor is that when you're drying out the grains, you dry them out with peat.
Right.
Yeah, and when you smoke the peat, then you ingrain that flavor into the whiskey. So you don't really get this process with the Glenmorangie.
Mm-hmm.
So, this is the opposite of the smoky. It's, accessible.
Okay.
Sweet.
So this is all made in Scotland.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. On the bottle, it says, perfected by the 16 men of Tain. Do you know what that means?
Okay. I have no idea. Well, Glenmorangie is from the Highland part of Scotland. So there's different regions of Scotland where you get these different varieties of scotch. So for example, all I know off the top of my head is Islay is the place where you get the most smoky whiskeys.
Okay, the peated whiskeys. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, are you ready?
Yeah,
cheers.
Brings us back to the Tinglewood days, right?
Exactly, yeah. Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
So it's very smooth. It's very sweet, as you said. It's almost like honey.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get that too.
And then the aftertaste is also a little bit bitter, but the sweetness at the front of it also combines with this aftertaste bitterness, so it's like not so bad, you know?
Yeah, you get the ethanol in the back.
Yeah, maybe that's what I'm reacting to. Yeah. Okay. The initial smell of it too is actually quite clean.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not like, sometimes when you sniff whiskeys or scotches or bourbons before, you can kind of get this big whiff of pungent smell.
It feels like you're burned.
Yeah. No, this is like, I'm not stifling a gag reflex at all drinking this. So this is the one you are most familiar with out of the sample pack.
Yeah, well, all of these samples are Glenmorangie, but they're different iterations, I guess. Mm-hmm. So we just tried the original, and then the other ones that we have, they start out in aged barrels at first, and then afterwards they're transferred over to different types of casks.
Okay.
So what we have in our sampler is a Glenmorangie that's finished in sherry cask.
Yeah.
One that is finished in port cask, and one that is finished in American bourbon cask.
Gotcha.
Like, yeah.
Right. Oak bourbon cask. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So now that we got the fundamental down, I feel like these are like harmonics or something. Harmonics. Actually, before we go on to the next one, I know with a bourbon tasting or whiskey tasting, sometimes you want to add either ice or water if something tastes a little stiff, or sometimes by adding just a little bit of water that actually opens up the drinking experience to be a little bit more enjoyable, or it opens up other flavors. Do you ever do that with scotch as well?
Yeah, definitely. With something like the Glenmorangie, which is already so friendly, I might not, but it might be interesting to do so. Maybe I'll try.
We'll have to go down the...
Sure. I do it more often with the whiskeys that have a higher alcohol content.
Yeah, right, because it kind of hits you in the face a little bit.
Yeah. So just to kind of temper and be able to actually taste without, you know, feeling like your mouth is burning, then I'd add a little bit of water.
Gotcha. Okay. And do you normally drink your whiskeys neat or rocks?
Most often neat.
Yeah.
But when it's a particularly hot day, like, I like a bit of
you want to cool it down.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. Do you want to move on to the next sample here? Okay. Are you doing the sherry cask now?
Yes, I am.
Okay. So what should we expect from a sherry casked scotch?
Honestly, I don't know sherry as a wine very well. I know port tends to be very sweet. And with a bourbon cask, we might get more vanilla or just a classic bourbon finish.
Yeah. Cheers again.
Cheers.
Ooh. Okay, I'm getting a little bit of a stronger, like, my nose hairs are a little bit tingly now after inhaling.
I'm getting more, there's a little bit more fighting going on.
Okay. So maybe this is one that you might want to put some water droplets in or something. I haven't tasted it yet. I was just going to say that maybe I'm just, like, reading into it, but it does sort of smell a little bit more like a little bit of wine is coming through.
Yeah.
I don't know if you feel that way or not.
Oh, definitely. Especially towards the back end. The tasting notes for this one with the sherry cask says ginger, dates, warm spices. So, I can definitely
get
that
ginger.
Heat. Yeah.
Yeah, the ginger is, like, present at the very beginning. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's also very tasty, though. I mean, it's not as smooth as the first one, but definitely a more complex flavor profile with all those notes that you're just talking about. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I used to be much more of a scotch person.
Okay.
But then, I think 2019, the U.S. put tariffs on scotch. So the prices went up significantly.
Yeah.
So, for example, the one I usually get, Lefroy, a smoking whiskey.
Yes.
It used to be $36 and now it's $50.
Yes, I know.
Yeah.
Because I want to buy Lefroy too. And I'm like, oh, it's just $50. I don't know if I can swing that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not this time. Yeah.
Yeah. I actually, one time at Specs.
Specs.
In Houston downtown.
Specs, for people who don't know, is a Texas-based liquor store. It's like a chain. Yeah. Go on though.
Yeah. I was just randomly there. And the head distiller of Lefroy just happened to be there as well. He was signing bottles. So I have a signed bottle by him in my shelf.
Did it cost anything to have him sign it?
No. I just grabbed the 10-year Lefroy bottle, which was back then $36. So I was like, okay, I can definitely, like, you know.
Yeah, swing this.
Yeah. So I just handed it to him and then he just signed it.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Do you have a photo? Can you send us a photo of that?
Yeah, I can. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's cool. What were the chances of him being in Houston at that random Specs? Was he doing some kind of tasting?
I think he was just making a tour throughout Texas.
Oh.
And then he just happened to be there. I think the downtown Specs in Houston gets a lot of that.
Okay. Yeah, not the one that's near Rice.
No. Not that smaller one.
What's that street?
Holcomb?
Is it Holcomb and Greenbrier?
Yeah.
I also think perhaps the last time for Kinetic that I was in Houston, I feel like you're driving me places. We were talking about scotch. We definitely had a conversation about how much peat we like in our scotches and things like that. Like, I like a peated scotch.
Yeah.
I like getting that, like, mossy flavor, and you call it smoky. Yeah, it's, for me, it's a little bit more herbal for that reason. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I'm not going to expect a peated scotch in this taste.
No, not at all.
That's okay.
Yeah.
We can do
another. Which is a
pity. We'll have to have you back on the podcast, and then we'll do a peated version of this.
There was another sampler box. When I searched it online on Total Wine, it was only available at a Total Wine's like 50 miles from me, and I didn't see it in Minnesota. But they're just like a smoky sampler box where Yeah, you have Lagavulin Talisker, $70 sampler box. That was, maybe I'll drive 50 miles just for the sampler, but you know, no. I can see it anywhere in Minnesota.
Yeah, so I understand. Like, okay, no, I appreciate that. Plus, I mean, I'm also very happy about the price point of these. No, I mean,
yeah.
And that's not to say I feel like I'm sounding like a cheapskate. Like, that's not to say that I will definitely shell out for a really nice bottle of, like, I just bought a really nice bottle of absinthe because I was like, okay, I really want to savor this one.
But yeah.
Every now and then, that's like not a normal thing. Anyway, do you want to go on to the next one?
Yeah, let's try the port cask.
So I'm going to ask you the same question. What can we expect from a port casked scotch?
I expect this to be the sweetest one out of the four. The tasting notes for this, well, they say honeysuckle, gold, tart chocolate.
So a little bit of sweet and a little bit of bitter.
Yeah.
Like maybe an exaggerated version of the first one that we tried.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow, this is a very different color.
Yeah, port wine tends to be very dark.
Yeah, the color of this is significantly darker. It's almost red.
And I think in addition, like, this is the oldest one out of the bunch. It's 14 years
old. That's true.
So it spent more time in the barrel.
Ooh, this is gonna be... Oh, it's also technically, it says ruby port casks, so I guess the red comes through.
Yeah, it's pretty.
Yeah, definitely. Ooh, and also when I smell it, it's like immediately, like, I get that honeysuckle that they're talking about.
Yeah.
I used to have honeysuckles in my backyard. Okay,
it
cheers.
It smells rich.
Yeah. That's nice. I like this one a lot. Do you like it?
It's probably not my yours. Favorite one, but like, it's a very round, nicely bitter aftertaste towards the end, which is, I think, like, it's very interesting.
Yeah. And like, I got a little bit of smokiness in this, or that peatedness. Did you not?
A little bit. I get a little bit of burn.
Oh, okay.
Maybe that's it. Okay.
I guess let me try it again.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get a little bit of, like, tongue burn in the middle of that taste. Okay, so you're not a fan. I'll take this one.
it's definitely not bad by any means, but
yeah,
I might go for the sherry cask. At the
okay, so out of the three, number two is the one that's...
Yeah, that okay. might be my jam.
So you were saying that because the tariffs were put on scotch in, what, you said 2019?
2019.
You said then you had to kind of stop buying scotch, and instead did you buy just bourbon or American whiskey? Wanted to kind of ask you about that. Like, I mean, I know the reason for it, but which ones did you start discovering, or are there any other... I know they're not ones that we're trying today, but...
I started experimenting more with Texas whiskeys.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so...
Are there distilleries around or in Houston that you visited? Okay. We'll have to go when I'm down in... Yeah, okay. We're going to have to
hang out. I'm not sure if there's... I think there is a distillery or two in Houston, but the ones I visited are in Austin.
Okay, so, okay.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of interesting stuff happening in the Texas whiskey scene, and it's a pretty young scene. I think maybe just like 10, 15 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think they're doing lots of interesting stuff. One example is, instead of using kind of traditional Scottish peat in order to kind of dry out their grains, there's one distillery called Andalusia that dries their grain with mesquite.
Oh,
yeah. Okay. So giving it like a Texas flavor to
it. Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Yes. I thought that was very interesting to do.
Is it tasty?
Yeah, it's tasty. Okay. It might be a little bit too sweet for my taste, but like, oh, this is different. This is nice. You know?
Okay.
So yeah, that's a great example of there's much to explore.
Absolutely.
With Texas whiskeys.
What would be your like top three recommendations for if someone was to walk into either in Texas or maybe hopefully elsewhere, if they distribute elsewhere? What are your like top three whiskeys that you would recommend for someone in a reasonable price point? Like, we're not gonna go and get like Whistle Pig, you know?
Yeah. If I could make one recommendation that's not whiskey but still by a distillery,
sure.
It's I think all my friends locally know this, but there is a tequila-ish liquor called Sotol. In Austin, there is a Sotol distillery.
Okay.
That I believe is the only, as of maybe a year or so ago, like the only distillery licensed to distill Sotol in the United States.
Wow. Okay.
And it's instead of using farmed agaves, I believe they use fresh agaves. So
okay.
there is a very nice sweetness in the back, in aftertaste.
Okay, so you can pick up a bottle of, I'm sorry, what's the distillery called again?
Oh, Desert Door Distillery.
Desert Door, okay.
Yeah.
Nice.
And it comes in a really nice, you know, heavy blue bottle. And it's really nice to look at while drinking also.
Okay.
So, I like
it. It's part of the, yeah.
Yeah. Sure. And so, yeah, if you ever go to, like, a Texas Specs or Total Wine, yeah, it's only recently that they started selling retail. They used to only sell at their own distillery in Austin,
right.
But now they're selling, I believe, that's statewide. Great. So if you're ever in Texas, I think that's a very good recommendation.
Yeah.
Second is any of the Andalusia stuff that I mentioned. Not only do they have their mesquite-smoked barbecue-like whiskey, but I think they have their own version of Scottish peated whiskey, too.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so they have different kinds of whiskeys themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And then my last recommendation is the whiskey that kind of put Texas in like the international scene is is Balcones. I believe, they were suddenly launched into the whiskey world 6-7 years ago, I believe. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when they won so many awards. So Balcones is also a good whiskey to try out.
Okay. Shall we open our final bottle?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So this is the, how do you pronounce this? Sauternes?
Yeah, Sauternes. I'm not sure. I just see in the fine print bourbon casks.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you like bourbon?
Yeah, I like bourbon.
Okay.
They're strong, but I like them.
Okay. I just came back from a vacation to Louisville. Shout out to all my Louisville friends. Ironically, though, the times that we wanted to go to distilleries, they were closed. And I was like, what? What? What's happening?
Oh.
But I was able to have a good, decent amount of bourbon when I was there. And two of which I'll just shout out since we're shouting out distilleries and things. One that was in Louisville is called Rabbit Hole. And they had a really nice rye. That's the one I tried at the distillery. And then also Angel's Envy was also very good. And then since being in Louisville, when I went to Total Wine to look for this set to record with today, I was just curious to see if I could find those bourbons. And I only could find Angel's Envy, and it was a $99 bottle of bourbon. And I was like, oh my god, I had no idea. You know?
Oh, the one that expensive? It might be a cask strength one.
I don't know. I have to go back. Yeah, I'll have to look again closer. But they had one, they also had one Rabbit Hole one, and that one was also like a $60 or $70 bottle, which to me was a bit surprising considering I was taking it for granted when I was in Louisville, you know?
Yeah. Well, Kentucky, it really is like the place for bourbon, right?
Oh, yeah. You can smell the bourbon when you're walking in that city. Yeah. It's just the grain smell is just kind of everywhere, which is kind of, is, you know, if you like bourbon, it's nice, you know?
Yeah. Anyway. Oh, I definitely would love to do like a bourbon trail.
Yeah.
Something like that in Kentucky.
Probably, I think my problem is I went to Louisville on a Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. Or no, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. So that's not the high peak of tourism in that city. So next time. Okay, cheers.
Cheers.
I smell vanilla a little bit on this front.
Yeah.
Did you smell that?
I get vanilla quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I get that burn.
I get the bourbon,
Classic bourbon burn, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, and it's actually quite, I feel pretentious saying this, but I feel like that aftertaste is like eating a brick of 90% dark chocolate. You know what I mean? It's like actually quite bitter. But because it's like so sweet, again, it's the same thing. It's so sweet at the front that the bitterness at the end is actually okay. Yeah.
This might be my favorite one.
This is your favorite one. Oh, yeah. Interesting. Okay, so you're going to rank bourbon. Bourbon casked one is your first. The sherry cask finish is your second favorite. Mm. Third favorite then is going to be that original aged 10 years, right?
Yeah.
And then the last is going to be the one that I liked a lot, the port. Mm-hmm. Okay, interesting. Do you have words to describe why?
I kind of like a fight. A little bit.
Okay.
This is a little bit. Like, I love my friendly whiskeys too, but you know, ones that are not so friendly, just a little bit I like.
They challenge you a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay. Or is it because you don't want to drink so quickly?
That I think that's it too. I've had way too many experiences of drinking too much.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, just enjoying myself sip by sip. And just being able to kind of bask.
No, totally. That's nice. All of these are very nice. Thank you for introducing me to this scotch and this set specifically. Definitely would be a nice gift for anybody who enjoys scotch. I highly recommend.
Yeah. I'm glad that you gave me idea. You said four whiskeys to try out. So, and then this was the perfect number.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, let me just try them all one more time.
Yeah. I'll try them with you.
Well, I was going to try to evaluate which is my favorite.
Oh, I see.
But you can try them with me. I'm not going to stop you. Wow, that 10 aged is like so smooth. It's like a lot of strong alcohol all at once too.
Yeah. Is it the bourbon?
Well, it is, but it's also like these are such strong sipper drinks.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to do it quickly, but then I'm still tasting the aftertaste of one and sniffing the next. And so it's like conflicting.
Yeah. The bourbon cask one would be great on the rocks.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I like them all. But if I was going to rank them in how I'm feeling right now, I still like that port cask a lot. I'm sorry. I know that's your least favorite, but
it's still a good one. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm gravitating towards that right now. Second would be maybe the sherry cask one. Mm. And then honestly, it's like up to my mood, the last two. If I'm going to enjoy one glass of one of these, yeah, it's just kind of like, do I want something that's just like really clean, really smooth, and just an enjoyable, relaxing afternoon? Or do I want, as you say, kind of that challenge of the last one? No, these are great.
That pork cask really was interesting.
Yeah. I think that's why I like it, because it's, I think for me, when I like drinking, or when I like eating food or consuming, I should say, in general, I think I gravitate towards the flavors that for me have a lot more complexity to it. And I think that that port one has the most things to pick out from it. Do you agree? Or okay.
Yeah. For me, I would have to be in a patient mood to be able to enjoy complexity.
Okay.
And maybe more often than not, I'm not. At times I'm patient, times I'm not patient. I'd say I'm a little bit more impatient than patient. Yeah. So.
Okay. Yeah. No, I get you.
It depends on my mood also.
Yeah. What I was going to say as well is, as I've also aged, I'm enjoying more and more of something like this, like a sipping alcohol that you're not going to binge drink on, or like, you know, you're not going to take shots, or it's like, that. Those days are over for me. So like, yeah, like having a little pour of one of these on any, as the sun is setting or whatever. In the summertime, nice. One of my other questions that I was going to ask you, though, is I know we're trying these all neat today, but are there any particular mixed drinks with either whiskey or scotches that you... I don't think people make mixed drinks with scotches, though, right?
Not typically.
Yeah, you typically just drink that straight, yeah.
Yeah, the mixed drinks that you do have with whiskey was whiskey sour, and what was the other?
Oh, well, I mean, whiskey sour Manhattan, Old Fashioned.
Old Fashioned, yeah.
I mean, there's...
They're typically done like with mint like julep. Bourbon. Yeah, but with scotches, I'm not sure. I don't think... I've come across a mixed drink with a scotch.
Are there any other last thoughts or things that you wanted to share about whiskey / scotch or this tasting that we did just now?
This was really nice to do. Like, I don't think I've had scotch since before the pandemic.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, it's, because during the pandemic, well, I didn't drink that much during the pandemic to begin with. But yeah, it's been a while for scotches, and it made me realize, oh, how much I miss them so much.
Okay.
Yeah.
Uh-oh. Is this the catalyst to like going back into the... No, I'm just...
Yeah, we'll have to have an intervention podcast in 6 months.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you again, as I said, for introducing me to these selections of scotch from this one company, Glenmorangie.
Yeah, I believe I'm saying it so wrong, but that's how you heard it. Yeah, or I've been told it's not the way I say it.
Oh, no!
I just keep it, you know, I just...
Wait, Sam! Wait, you can't... Wait, have we just been mispronouncing this entire time?
Well, I think non-Scottish people say Glenmorangie.
Okay, so how do Scottish people say... Any Scottish listeners? Let us know.
Please don't cancel us.
Don't cancel us. Because we're just stupid Americans. All right, okay. Well, I'm gonna... Are you looking it up?
Yeah. Okay. Glenmorangie.
Morangie, so it's Morangie. Accent on the more.
Yeah, I think so.
You want more of the Glenmorangie.
Yeah.
Okay.
This might be the way you end your podcast career. What? You know?
Oh, yeah, mispronunciation. Being canceled because of...
Yeah.
I mean, that would be either a sign that society has really gotten to cancel culture-y, or I don't know, because I mean, I don't think it's that offensive. I don't know.
Or most of your listeners are Scottish people.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, Sam, can I ask you two final questions?
Yeah.
What is one piece of advice you would tell your younger self about entering and pursuing a music career?
The one piece of advice I'd say is that, well, I've been told this by many other people, but as I get older, I realize how much easier and easier it gets to be cynical about the profession.
Yeah.
There are many reasons why to be like, wow, you know, this profession is not great. But yeah, to do all that you can to kind of fight against that and just kind of keep on remembering why you chose to be in this profession in the first place, and also keep exploring new reasons why this profession is worth being in. This constant exploration and constant introspection, I think, is important.
Do you have an idea or a way of explaining why cynicism creeps into our profession?
A lot of it is due to how idealistic we are as younger people. Or just the way that we're taught, the way that we look up to soloists. We don't look up necessarily to the back of the second violins of an orchestra. Although, you know, they are just as important as the front.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, also, so, like, just as good. Like,
yeah. So it's not necessarily misplaced idealism, but yeah, or just the idealism that is just not necessarily realistic. And yeah, realizing later on, okay, you know, 99% of us, that is, we're not going to be soloing with the Berlin Philharmonic. So, but you know, there are still reasons why to love this profession.
Totally. You know, it doesn't mean interacting you can't
with
try.
Yeah, interacting with people in the local area is such a great way to get away from that cynicism. To figure out how you can be useful and important in your community. I think that's a good way to ward off cynicism.
Yeah, because I think that gives you that instant feedback of gratification. When you get that so easily in school, or, you know, or criticism, both are very strong at school. But then once you leave school, more times than not, you're going to receive, it's like connecting, as you say, connecting with your local community in some way, either that being a ensemble or a solo performance or whatever performance you might have, you're still connecting with people that are grateful, even if it's not voiced, that they are grateful that you are performing for them in that moment. Yeah. And that is easy. I think a lot of us had that kind of callousness maybe prior to the pandemic, but now coming out of the pandemic is not taken for granted as much.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, and my second question, as we enter a post-pandemic world, now that mask mandates are being lifted, what elements of your musical pandemic life would you want to continue, and what would you want to shed?
Like you said, Vito, we took a lot for granted before the pandemic in terms of not understanding how much we need other people locally in our community. I'd say at least for the post-pandemic, I'm just glad to have the people around me there.
Yeah.
Through the pandemic, you know, Kinetic, we did stuff during the pandemic. Even though it was not the string ensemble that we want to have, the full string ensemble, but we were able to still do quartets, small ensembles. We did like this trio version of the Bach's Goldberg Variations. Yeah, so not taking for granted anymore with the small things, with the people who are already around me, and cherishing them a lot more. That's something that I really love to have and will want to continue to love to have post-pandemic. Yeah, one thing I want to shut off during the pandemic, classical music as elitist. Yeah, Black Lives Matter, that movement, really, I think, helped realign our focus, especially us musicians in America, figuring out, you know, what music means to us as Americans. Right. Rather than, oh, you know, it's this high-class European art form that we should, you know,
continue to put our nose up. Yeah, or as like put on a pedestal in a glass cage. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sam, are there any platforms or websites for listeners to learn more about you or any upcoming projects?
Yes, please check out kineticensemble.org.
Nice.
And if you are in Houston, please check out our concert on May 22nd. And if you're not in the area or you can't come to the concert on that date, I believe we have a live stream performance too. So you can check us out online.
Oh God. I better practice. Yeah. No, I'm just kidding. No, definitely check out Kinetic. You will not be disappointed by the quality of the performing and the content of the music. And we didn't necessarily talk about this earlier, but what's also so great about Kinetic is that we are all friends on stage. You can't necessarily say that about every ensemble. You know, a lot of times it's not always that level of respect and that level of camaraderie. So that's why I also always get very excited to come back to Kinetic, because it's like a reunion of friendship in music on stage. And the teamwork is on a higher level that, anyway, I'll stop plugging Kinetic. It's a good time. It's a good time.
Yeah.
And then we can get tacos after and drink some whiskey and everything will be great. All right.
The Ice House. Yeah.
Yeah, to Ice House. Exactly. Yeah. Shout out to Ice House. And Tacos Tierra Caliente, of course. Yes. Can't forget their partnership there. All right. And if you're listening, be sure to smash that subscribe button wherever you're tuning into this podcast. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts while you're at it. It doesn't need to be long. Your review will help others search for the podcast because of its crazy algorithms, and you'll make Sushi's day, and it's free. Make sure to share this podcast with your friends and family as well. If you want to level up, you can always become part of the Haydn Behind the Music Stand family by donating donating what you will on our Patreon page at patreon.com/HaydenMusicStand. Our social media handle for Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter is @HaydenMusicStand, and we'd love to hear from you at our email, HaydenMusicStand@gmail.com. Didn't recognize a piece we discussed during the episode? No worries. There's a Spotify playlist with all the music discussed for your convenience. The link is in the description of each episode. Sam, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. Yeah, it is such a pleasure.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me here, Patty.
Absolutely. Anytime. I'm, again, so looking forward to actually hanging out in person.
Yeah,
in May.
It's been a while.
It's been 3 years. It's too long. Yeah.
Yes.
Anyway, and thanks for listening. Sushi, say bye.